Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. Today, I'm very excited to bring a special guest. Jeff, I'm sure you've heard this a number of times. I probably could interview most anybody, and I'm grateful for it, but there's something about interviewing somebody like yourself who's been able to see the world from a perspective that very few of us ever will, at least personally. So I'm here today with Colonel, and I'm going to call you Jeffrey Williams. Jeff is a retired United States Army officer and a NASA astronaut. He's a veteran of 4 space flights and formerly held the American record for most days spent in space. How many days was that?
534.
He's worked on hundreds of experiments. And one of the things I thought is really cool is he's walked in space a couple times. And then at one point, and maybe you still do, you were known for what? Taking more photographs of Earth than anybody? Is that still true?
Yes, I think so.
And you do have a book where you've captured a bunch of those photos, and it's called The Work of His Hands, A View of God's Creation from Space. Full transparency, we met through a mutual friend, and this mutual friend and he are involved with a company called Smart Organs Solutions. I am an investor, so just want to keep that full transparency. So Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Are you okay if I call you Jeff?
Absolutely. It's great to be with you, Jeff. We won't get confused in names today.
All right. So start off, just give us a little bit of perspective of who you are, maybe where you grew up, where you went to school, and then a brief summary of your career.
Sure. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, actually, in a small dairy farm. My father was a school teacher. My uncle inherited the farm from my grandfather. So I grew up, you know, learning hard work, farm work. I graduated from high school and went right to the military academy at West Point. And that started basically 40 years of first 27 years active Army. Most of that time serving as a pilot and an experimental test pilot with degrees in engineering. But then halfway through that 27 years, I got accepted by NASA as an astronaut. So the rest of the time, up until 2 years ago, I served at NASA, first active duty, and then as a NASA civil servant.
And what are you doing today?
Today, I am doing a variety of things. I'm spending a lot of time serving at a church. As you mentioned, I'm also in a startup company, Smart Organ Solutions. It was the immediate one, but we actually have a global company too. We call it Smart Optimal Solutions, where we're expanding to not only across the U.S., but trying to get into the continents of South America, Central America as well as Africa. We have vendors in Africa and Southeast Asia. So that's maybe a story for another day, but that's been a lot of fun, starting something from scratch. And then maybe we'll talk about a little bit more later, but on the nonprofit side, I serve on several boards, but I'm leading an initiative to develop what I call a Science and Wonder Center with a focus on STEM plus art. So STEAM, with a focus on STEAM education and stimulating young people in those areas.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm sure there's stuff we can chat about there. So one question, and this is a weird way to word this, I'm going to throw it out to you. So obviously you've accomplished a lot, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of those things, but how would you best describe who you are today in the context of kind of where you're at in your life journey?
I think I would have to say, I'd have to start with, I'm a child of God, redeemed by Christ. My Christian faith really informs everything that I do and how I live and how I approach the challenges of life and the opportunities of life. I consider it a stewardship of life. And having 4 flights in space off the planet, and you mentioned the book, you know, the book was driven largely to communicate a little bit of that perspective. But my entire career in space at NASA was dedicated to the building of the International Space Station. Now, the media always claimed that was a $100 billion project. So it was a major project over many years. We started building it in 1998. My first visit there was in 2000. We finished it in 2010 while I was on board on my third flight. And then my final flight was in 2016, and it's full operational mode, and it continues to fly even to today. Very international, Europeans involved, Japanese involved, Canadians involved, and more significantly, perhaps in a geopolitical sense, the Russians involved. So that gave me a broad experience and opens the door, right? Everybody seems to want to talk to, have an interest in hearing a perspective from an astronaut and the space. So that has opened the door to many things, to include, as we mentioned, business, to include technology, to include inspiring people. So I see all of life as stewarding what the Lord has given me over those many years. And I really saw it at the front end of my time at NASA. I knew that it was very unique. I applied for 10 years, interviewed 3 times with NASA, Started in the mid 80s and got selected in 1996. And so when I finally got selected in 1996, I knew that it was going to be a unique opportunity. I didn't know what was in front of me, but I had a very acute sense of the importance of stewarding those experiences that were to come.
If you were to summarize a short statement or whatever, how did space change you the most?
Well, it gives you a different perspective. You know, when we're on the planet, we get a little bit of a broad perspective, perhaps visually, when we're flying on a commercial airline and we cross the country and we cross an ocean and go to a different continent and we're there, you know, overnight or whatever. That gives us a different perspective of scale, say, if we never leave our hometown area. It's a completely different scale to orbit the Earth, be off the planet and see it as a globe. And just as an aside, I get the flat Earth questions all the time. The Earth is not flat, I can guarantee you. But flat Earthers won't believe me anyway, because I'm part of the conspiracy. But
it's funny when you were saying that, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, oh boy.
But orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes, think about it, 16 times a day at an inclination of 51.6 degrees. So that what that means is we go from 51.6 north latitude to 51.6 south latitude. So you see the entire globe of the Earth, except for the polar regions directly, and you know exactly when you're going to be where, so you can predict your crossing. And so it's a great opportunity to study the Earth and see all those points on the Earth in different lighting conditions, day, night, high sun angles, low sun angles, watch seasons go by. So it's just a different scale, I guess, you're working in terms of perspective.
Assuming I am could handle it, which I think I might struggle, feeling like I'm going to be sucked out into nowhere. What do you think if I was next to you and the first time up there, what would you think would be my, I mean, I know you don't know me well enough, but as a general statement, what would a normal dude like me go, oh, I never dreamed of this or that or whatever?
Well, actually, over my career, I shared the experience with 56 different individuals. And many of those, I had been there a while, and I'm seeing people arrive for the first time. You know, so that included crewmates, included crews we were replacing when we arrived, crews that were replacing us, visiting space shuttle crews. I hosted 4 space shuttle crews during my long stays on the space station. So I saw a lot of that. And of course, everybody is just overcome with the sensations of the vantage point, and the Earth becomes the favorite thing to study and to watch. I would also say that it's very possible, statistically, that you would be suffering some very severe sickness. You know, think of it in the category of motion sickness. There would be some regrets or wondering, you know, what did I get myself into? But everybody recovers from that within usually a couple of days or so, and then you adapt. But still, it can take, not everybody stays there for this long, but for those that stay for a long period of time, I saw an adaptation to work in the environment, to be able to function in the environment that was visible over about 6 weeks of time. So it takes a while to adapt to that weightless environment and being able to operate really in 3 dimensions. We largely operate in 2 dimensions here on the ground, forward, back, right and left, and a little bit of vertical, but we're very limited in vertical. Up there, any orientation can be up and down. You know, you're working in 3 dimensions inside the volume rather than across the floor. So there's a lot of elements to it. And then people, when they first get there, they're sensor saturated. You know, if you're there for a short period of time and you're very busy, you're focused on trying to get all the work done, you can be back on the ground after landing and look around and say, well, what just happened to me? I missed most of it because of the sensory overload.
What about your sleep? Does it screw your sleep up?
Yeah, I would say it compromises your sleep, and you just have to accept the fact that you're not going to rest as deeply up there, and you learn how to manage a level of fatigue. That's manageable. It's a unique sensation to sleep. You don't have the pressures of a mattress. You know, you're floating all the time. So you just have the sensation of touch inside the sleeping bag that you're in. And you use a sleeping bag not only to keep you comfortable, warm, and it's a light sleeping bag, but you also tie the sleeping bag to the wall so you're not floating around everywhere. So you're just floating inside this mummy style sleeping bag.
Yeah, it's a crazy world. Well, I could keep going down all of those questions, but shift to, and please answer with that context of what you've experienced. So one question we love to ask guests is, how are you trying to change the world today? whether it's big, whether it's small, just curious from your perspective how you're trying to change the world.
Well, that's a big question. Again, it's a stewardship of the opportunities that I've been given. So I spent a lot of time, you asked what I do earlier. I did not mention, I spent a lot of time traveling and speaking at the request of, in conference settings and church settings and in different settings. I'm going to Moldova in April, speaking to both companies there, as well as a youth conference, as well as some government entities, the Science Institute there in Moldova. So that's an example of an international trip. Last year, I was in Poland, Brazil, and Singapore, Malaysia, giving talks, and then across the country in different forms. And what I try to do, in terms of my Christian faith in particular, I have found that my drive is to redeem an understanding of science, technology, engineering, math, and even art through a biblical worldview. Historically, the age of science, what some call the scientific revolution, really occurred largely because of a biblical worldview. And you hear those names, Isaac Newton, Boyle, Kepler, Maxwell, Faraday, all those guys were believers, and they were driven. They were called to their scientific endeavor with a biblical understanding. So you could say that largely I'm trying to redeem that perspective, which I think is the true perspective. The one that counters it, of course, you know, with the whole theories of evolution and all that, I find in my study of history, largely, I call it the most successful propaganda campaign in modern history, because it was built not on science at all. It was built on propaganda. So anyway, that's where I find myself. And that's what I'm really stewarding because of the open doors, the credibility that comes with what I've been able to do over the years.
You know, you use the word redeemed, and I don't often outwardly talk about this, not because I'm afraid to. It just doesn't necessarily flow. But in the impact investing world, when I transition from, let's just call it traditional investing, which is nothing morally wrong or anything wrong with that, but this is just being more intentional. One of the phrases that I would use is, like, I'm a capitalist at heart, absolutely believe in capitalism, but I do think capitalism needs to be redeemed. And it's because as soon as you get human beings with fear and greed and power, then that capitalistic society or structure can get overrun. And so really, it's funny you use that word, because that's what I view impact investing is. This is a way to try to redeem capitalism, as opposed to there is definitely a bent out there that's throwing this over to socialism. And I'm like, I think we've seen long enough. That's not the answer.
That's right. It's hard to stay in a narrow path for humanity. We go off to one side or another. So, yeah, it's the cultivation of wisdom and understanding, a little bit of what we're alluding to be able to stay on the straight path. Capital investment, technology is the same category, can be used for good, or it could be used for evil. And you mentioned two words that are on my mind all the time in terms of motivations of people. Fear and greed kind of are temptations. And both of those responses, of course, take you off the path.
So let's go down this capital path. And you can answer this however you want. When did you realize the power of capital? And what does the power of capital to you mean?
That's a broad question, too. As I mentioned, I grew up on a farm, so I think I had a sense of it, although maybe I couldn't articulate it for a while. Early on, a farm takes, you know, using that terminology, takes a capital investment to produce largely what we call produce wealth, to produce a product, to produce it for the market, to be able to make a return on it. So even in a very simple way, in a small 100-acre farm, I grew an appreciation for that. I grew an appreciation for the work that's required and the work ethic required to make it a go. I learned early on the risk involved. This was in the 70s, and we know historically there's very few small farms left, because they couldn't be sustainable. They weren't sustainable. So all the farms were gobbled up eventually. Either they went away altogether, or they were gobbled up, corporate scaled kind of farms. And that's what we have today. So, you know, observing that after I left and went in the military and saw some of my friends basically go bankrupt at a family level because of that, that grew an appreciation. I've never been a consumer. I think that the distractions that many in America have, particularly from understanding the importance of capital from a personal point of view, from a household point of view, largely distracted from this consumeristic drive that we have, where we almost feel obligated to go buy things that are not investments. They're consumables, you know, literally. I grew to appreciate that early on, I think largely from my parents. So I've never been a consumer per se. My purchases are meet needs. Certainly they meet some comforts and there's some enjoyment you come out of purchases. But I, large purchases, I've had a sense of investment. You know, is this an investment for me? Even a car, you know, early on, you know, teenagers or in 20s, a car is the big deal. It was never important to me to have the latest and greatest and the hottest car, you know, until maybe someday when I could afford it and could afford the luxury of that. So I lived on used cars and cars that were very practical, that performed the function that I needed. I also appreciated early on the importance and the responsibility from a household of saving and then later investing for my family to preserve some security for my wife if something were to happen to me. Remember, I was a military pilot right from the beginning. So there are risks involved in that vocation. And certainly there are risks involved in spaceflight. So I had an acute sense of being responsible to preserve a future for my wife if something happened to me, and then our two kids. So that got me involved in not only saving for the unexpected expense that would come, something breaking down or whatever, but also looking further in the future for college, for the kids, and purchasing a house. I recognized that owning property was very important in that sense to build wealth over time. And in the military, you have kind of a limited opportunity to purchase homes. But at the same time, you have an opportunity, if you purchase, to flip homes because you're always getting assigned. So I didn't do that well at that early on, but it got better later. I got involved early on with the idea of investing. IRAs, of course, came on the scene. And so I dabbled initially with, you know, in mutual funds back in those days, and then later got more diversified. And now I'm very comfortable trading stocks. I don't do the exotic stuff only because I don't want to spend the time studying it. But so over the years, that grown in appreciation and execution also has enabled us to build a little bit of personal wealth to secure that future. I remember back in one of the things that opened my eyes was especially coming out of the Vietnam era. And that's when I entered, hearing about general officers, 3- and 4-star generals that died and left a widow bankrupt because they're, you know, if they were relying on retirement pay, their retirement virtually went away when they died and their widows left with nothing. So that was one example that I saw early on. And of course, the policy changed to try to protect, give the opportunity to protect widows as well. But, you know, just little lessons like that accumulated over my life.
Yeah, you bring up this idea of growing up on a farm. Interesting enough, we do some investing in regenerative farmland. And there's just something about farming that obviously it goes back millennia or whatever the right word is. But there's something about farming. It seems to really ground people. I mean, maybe it's because it forces you to look over long periods of time. It's not clearly not simple. But just as you're talking, I lived in the Midwest when I was a junior in high school through college. And the Midwest, generally farming kind of in their blood, is just such solid people. And yet, ironically, farming, as you said, is really, I mean, most people don't even understand where food comes from these days. So you just wonder, and now it's starting to tilt back where, you know, understanding what the farmers' needs are, where they're at, how closely, it's circling back around. So the other thing is you mentioned the word stewardship several times earlier. What does stewardship mean to you, and how are you living that out?
Stewardship is rightly understood, recognizes that we don't own anything in life. And that includes our time, our talents, our abilities, our opportunities, and our treasures, of course. And it's 100% of life. So stewardship is 100% of life. Everything that I have has been given to me by God. What I have been able to work toward and get is that even that ability has been given me by God. The opportunities have been given me by my creator, who's also my redeemer as a Christian. So a sense of stewardship recognizes the responsibility to steward what has been given. Part of that is related to your earlier question on my understanding of the capital. There's also the accumulation of capital comes in different ways. In Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 8, says, it's a reminder to the people of God, do not forget your God and do not think that you accumulate wealth because of your own power. It is God that gives you the power to make wealth. That's a great reminder. Largely, it's a sense of pride. We'll think that we do it all, and we don't. So that's a huge perspective. But back on capital, there's also an element of capital we didn't talk about and might be referred to as cultural capital. And there's a stewardship of that as well. And so speaking personally, the opportunity that I got starting in 1996 to be an astronaut at NASA, recognizing that stewardship, again, it brings interest, credibility. It brings an authority to, I could take advantage of that for personal gain, right? I could go, you know, build a brand and make all kinds of money that would enable me to have those hot cars and all those other things we talked about for my personal comfort. But that's not how I want to approach it. I recognize that there's a cultural capital that I've been given to steward is to inspire people and maybe have them look a little bit beyond themselves. So that's a stewardship. That's managing everything that I've been given to with the responsibility to manage by the owner who's God himself.
Well, knowing you the little bit that I do, hearing you today, look, I'm sure you enjoy traveling and whatnot. If, you know, for you to be traveling around giving these messages, I'm assuming it, you know, whatever percentage, but I think a chunk of that is you feeling your calling to be a steward of the knowledge and the experiences that you had. And it is interesting. I mean, you think about an astronaut, and I mean, you could be a professional athlete, all this stuff. There's something about an astronaut, and I've never really thought about it. But it's in its own little sphere. And maybe it's because there's just so few of them. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on why it's and so different? Or you know, do you agree with that statement?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I recognize that. Personally, I don't think it's that big of a deal. It's just a job that I had in some sense. But I recognize that, no, it brings a lot of fascination from virtually everybody. I know that you can't even begin to imagine what it's like to be weightless, to, you know, nobody can unless they experience it. And of course, our challenge is try to articulate that to get a little bit of a sense. But we struggle with even being able to articulate the experience or the view of the Earth and everything else. I mean, I didn't talk about spacewalks. I did 5 spacewalks where you go outside, you're hanging on the...
Give us a little perspective of that.
Yeah. So you get in this big suit. The suit itself becomes your life support system. And of course, protecting you from the environment outside takes about 5 hours or so to prepare to go outside. And then you're outside for 6.5, 7 hours, just going hand over hand outside the space station. And spacewalks were required to build it and then to maintain it as well. And like I said, I did 5 of them. And so you're outside orbiting the Earth, several orbits, day, night. Can be a very intimidating environment. We respect it very highly.
You feel speed?
Well, you see speed. You know, we cross North America in 10 minutes. But at the same time, you're weightless. If you're staring at the structure of the space station, you just feel like, okay, that's all I see. You got to get away from it. And then you see, one, the Earth. If you're on the lit side of the Earth where the sun is in view, the blackness of space is intense. You know, it's just deep, deep black out there. And then you have the globe of the Earth and the structure of the space station. When you're on the dark side of the Earth, you know, where the sun is on the other side, the night side of the Earth, then there's just this amazing array of stars in the sky. And I call it the ultimate skydive. It's the most challenging thing we do physically and mentally. Working in the suit is physically, you have to work very smart, not hard.
Why is that?
Well, because it's big and bulky. The arms don't articulate as freely as we would want to. It's under pressure. So think about being inside a balloon, a long balloon, and trying to, you know, every time you bend the balloon, you have to use force. So it's 100% oxygen under pressure, and you just have to, work smartly and not hard in the suit. And again, it's 7 hours outside. So your hands especially get a really good workout, but it's the highlight of the entire experience to be outside. That's why I call it the ultimate skydive. Mentally, it's the hardest thing we do because the entire 7 hours is highly choreographed. And we're working with mission control, working through the checklist, but you're focused, you're concentrating on, okay, what's next? Okay, this is the task I got to do. This is what I'm going to do. These are the tools I'm managing. This is the equipment I'm managing. Every 100% of everything is tethered if it's ever loose, because you don't want to lose anything. In particular, you don't want to lose yourself. So you are safety tethered 100% of the time. So there's a lot to it, but it's like I said, it's the highlight.
So the last question that we tend to ask, and I still have one more for you, the question you probably get a ton, but if you could have a dream come true for your life between now and when you go to heaven, and I'm going to try to leave your family out of it because I'm assuming there'd be something there. What would that dream be? And you can have a couple if you need to.
Well, I'll throw out one because it's sort of, it's right at the doorstep right now. Been cultivating an idea now for actually several years, but it really took off about a year and a half to develop it's both a destination and a regional resource focused on STEAM, science, technology, engineering, art, and math. And of course, as mentioned before, my faith has informed me in terms of science. There's a mathematical ordering of all of creation that is, I think, infinitely precise. Historically and currently, we're just limited by our ability to measure it. There's a physical order, a scientific order as well, physical, chemical, optical order. Everything is precisely ordered. We call it things operating on the laws of nature. Well, a law requires a lawgiver. So that's an aspect of God's work of creation that is largely missed. In fact, it's usually thought as all those topics are secular. They're outside the religious sphere of life. So this science center, I call it the PNW for Pacific Northwest Science and Wonder Center, is envisioned to be the baselining right now at the beginning of the development, 100,000 square foot science center, educational resource to educate, to stimulate, to encourage, to bring a sense of exploration and discovery to primary audience. Of course, will be students, but it's really intended for people of all ages, I suppose. I'm collaborating with some of your listeners might be familiar with the Creation Museum in Kentucky and the Ark Encounter, which is one of the major destinations in the region. I've been there several times. It's had a big impact. Well, we're collaborating with that organization to develop this, but it'll be space themed. Because of my identity, I personalize it a little bit, but it'll be focused on all of STEAM. And phase two is envisioned to even be a conference center. So, you know, a place where you can have bigger activities. And again, using the words we used before, to redeem a biblical understanding of STEAM. Because it is absolutely amazing when you get into it. The detailed design of all things that capital investment enables the exploration, the discovery. I mean, just think of ores in the ground, but also the mathematical ordering of things, the development and the utilization of all things throughout history. So I often use the time as an illustration. The measurement of time, I said earlier that I believe that the order is infinitely precise. We're just limited by our ability to measure it. Well, if you look at the measurement of time over history, it's directly proportional to the development of technology. You know, being able to navigate longitude on a rolling ship required a time reference from where you left, because now we know time zones, right? And until they got a clock that worked on a rolling ship, they didn't leave side of the coast largely, and that enabled the discovery of the Western Hemisphere, the North American. And then we go through the measurement of time with clocks. And when we were kids, quartz watches were a new thing. And it was within a second or two every day or something like that. And fast forward, you know, now we've got down to microseconds over long periods of time, and enables everybody's smartphone and all the other devices to share information almost immediately, any kind of information, access information, communication throughout the world. And it's all directly a result of the ability to measure and manage time. So that's an example. So that's a resource that's always been there. And we, by the way, who bear the image of the Creator, have been given the capacity to, one, have the curiosity, the wonderment, to go search, to explore, to discover something, to experiment. What if I do this? What if I add heat to this rock? Whoa, it turns into something else. And oh, by the way, yesterday I did this other experiment over here and I discovered, what if I combine the two? You know, I developed something else that's useful. And that's the big picture of what I'm trying to get folks to understand. So that would be my dream. If I could realize that, I think that would leave a legacy that would maximize the stewardship opportunity I've had for my life.
Do you, and this is, well, I don't mean a literal picture of the facility, but that could be it too. Do you have a picture in your mind when you think about this idea or concept that kind of pulls you to it? Or is it like, I don't really have anything crystallized in a visual?
Oh, I've got a multi-paper detailed list of both functions and elements in the facility. You know, I've done a lot of study of museums, of science centers, of other entities, and not to mention the content, you know, the technical content. I've got a lot of experience at that too. So no, I've got a lot of detail. We're in the middle of right now of developing the communication tools, the branding. I've got a...
Is there a website people could go to?
Well, it's not open yet. It's not. It's I'm trying to develop the whole IT infrastructure, and I've had a very generous donation of that resource to do that. So not just trying to go out and build my own website, you know, and throw it out there and then have to do something real later. So yeah, I've got some resources already that have donated. This is too early to go public, but I'm working on a real promising piece of land right now that working with the owners. So I think we're right on the doorstep of going a little bit more public and starting to raise the capital because I really needed to find dirt first before you go to capital sources and just try to raise capital on an idea. I've got an architectural firm. I've got a research group doing the studies. I've got the IT work. I've got the marketing resources all at the table.
Well, when you are ready to launch that, we can add that, come back to the podcast, add that in the description. This does go out in a newsletter. We can always send that out. Okay, the last question I have for you, and I don't even know the right way to answer it, but well, I'll ask it this way. The conspiracy theory of, we never walked on the moon. What do you say to that?
Utter foolishness. You know, well, it's related to flat earth. All flat earthers also say we never walked on the moon. Not all those that say we never walked on the moon are flat earthers. But nowadays, they often come together. And the flat earth thing has been, that's my answer, utter foolishness. And actually, I'm a little concerned about those folks. But people love conspiracies. And there's in a lot of conspiracies, especially related to recent political activities, social problems or whatnot, there's elements of truth in it, but they're always extrapolated out beyond those elements, inventing a conspiracy. You know, I tell people with the moon landing 55 years, we're going on 55 years since the first moon landing in 1969, July 1969. The whole world watched the space race. The race was between two arch enemies in the Cold War, the Soviet Union and the United States. There was a lot of activity going on, development of rockets and all of that. It was very visible to the public. There were tens of thousands of people involved directly at some level in the development of the capability to go to the moon and the operation to go to the moon. We had our arch enemies, intelligence services, watching everything we were doing as we were watching them. And then we not only did it once, but we did it six times. Most people aren't aware of Apollo 12, Apollo 14, 15, 16, 17, because everybody lost interest. The media lost interest. Everybody knows about Apollo 13. Only because of the Tom Hanks movie. It was a rescue mission, basically, to get the crew back. But we did it six times, so 12 men walked on the moon. And all that time has gone by. Do you know how hard it would be to keep the secret after so much time and so many people involved and doing it six times? It's much easier just to have gone and done it.
That actually puts a perspective on it. Well, I appreciate you sharing some of your experience and your wisdom, and we'll be cheering for you as you look to live out your dream. Obviously, I stay in touch with at least Patrice and you through SOS. So we'll watch to see how that comes to fruition. Anything you want to say in closing to our guest?
This whole capital world, which is largely your audience, is relatively new to me at this level, at this scale. But this startup company that we talked about, as well as this Science and Wonder Ventures, is I'm having a lot of fun getting into it. And I recognize it's a stewardship too, right? And we have a responsibility to not only build capital, but to manage it. And part of that stewardship, part of that responsibility, large part, is doing it responsibly, you know, for the greater good.
Well, and candidly, that's one of the reasons why my wife and I invested in Patrice and SOS, as well as its connection to Africa, because my brother lives in Rwanda. But it's hard not to be inspired, just like, but to be inspired by you and your passion for science and art. it's hard not to be inspired by people who are using capital as a force for good. You want to see those people win, not only, you know, for themselves, but also, my gosh, the positive things that capital and ideas coming together to make a difference. You know, I was with my son this last weekend. He's an officer in the military. And, you know, you hear some of the stuff that he's dealing with. And he's actually helping with basic training right now. You stop and think, and you know, we have a whole, there's a whole system in this globe that all we're trying to do is be prepared to stop some other country. And so it's easy to get caught up of like just the negative side of life. And both exist at the same time. You have such amazing opportunities to make the world a better place. Meanwhile, you still have evil in this world. I think the more you understand the evil in the world, the more amazing the opportunities and to put a shit in the other direction just gives real meaning to life. And it's a privilege to be on that journey.
Yeah, meaning and personal satisfaction come with serving, with giving of yourself. You know, folks that endeavor to, you know, for personal gain only are never satisfied and frankly live in misery.
It's true. Well, thanks again. And for our listeners, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital in your podcast app of choice. Till next time, Jeff Schaefer, and take a look out at the evening sky tonight and think about Colonel Williams and the fact that there are people up there, I guess, looking back at us. Now, that's crazy. So, Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital. It does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.